Dr. Mark Stinson talking about medical response to emergencies in Kosovo.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here, and I want to thank Jane and Howard and Paul for asking me to speak. As they're putting my slides on, I just want to give you a little introduction on, you know, what my training and how I got involved in this. I'm a family practitioner originally, and then now I practice full-time emergency medicine at the county hospital in Martinez, California. I've had an interest in international work ever since college, and I went into medicine partially to be able to do, you know, international relief, international work. And over the last 3 years, disaster relief has kind of fallen into my lap. So let's go with the first slide. So what I'm going to be doing is, through my experience, explain what this is. Has anyone ever heard this term before, complex humanitarian emergency? This is a disaster. And I'll give the definition shortly. And these are some prime examples of a complex humanitarian emergency. Now, needless to say, any kind of nuclear blast would be immediately, you know, would define this term. But these are examples of both natural and man-made disasters. And I'm going to use Kosovo and Bosnia to help explain this. So there are greater numbers for numerous reasons, and I'll go over those shortly. Before this time, they were hidden. During the Cold War, the different sides didn't want criticism, so they basically hid the fact that they had these terrible internal disasters. So this is what makes up a complex humanitarian emergency. I've got a handout, and it'll be in the CD, and I think this is, I've kind of distilled down the most important points. So think about Bosnia, think about Kosovo. Mortality, morbidity, you know, death and disability, large population, livelihoods, their ability to cope, buildings, and healthcare. This is pretty intuitive. And in Africa, they don't treat the children, they treat the women first. Because in Africa, in a situation where there are limited resources, the children will universally die if the mother dies. Because the other families do not have the resources to care for them, so they will be lost. So the money goes into the women. And, you know, think about the gypsies, think about minority groups. So enter Bosnia. In 1986, shortly after the Dayton Accord, I was asked to go to a small town north of Sarajevo, a war hospital, to train emergency medicine residents that were involved in the front. So here's Kosovo, Albania, just so you have a sense of what my experience was. As everyone knows, just to kind of go over the history very quickly, Greater Serbia included all the colored areas. Greater Serbia was controlled by Tito, and he had all the different ethnic groups cooperate with each other because of his central authoritarian rule. The Catholics, the Orthodox, and then a small group of Muslims in the center. The Muslims were given power under Tito, not because they had power, not because they had any reason to have power except that it was the right thing to do. He created a democracy of sorts. Once the Serbs took over, they had none of that, and they basically forced out the Muslims. So I landed on the coast, and then we had to go across these mountains to get into Bosnia itself. These are Croatian troops, and in taking this photograph, I was almost killed by this gentleman with a Kalashnikov because he thought it was that I might have been a spy, and he felt as if he needed to shoot me. So he was like, you know, pointing his automatic weapon and shaking. And, you know, it's one thing if they point just to scare you, but he didn't know whether he was supposed to shoot me or not. So I learned very quickly to be careful with the camera. So now we've entered Bosnia. There were tanks everywhere. On every crossroads, there was a tank. And then people would just walk by to the market.
What year was that?
This was in 1986. The Dayton Accord was the end of 85. Then I returned again in 87. So this is Sarajevo, this is a newspaper building, and it was a particularly tempting target for the Serbian gunners in the hills because it was a newspaper building. They continued to publish throughout the entire onslaught of Sarajevo. They didn't miss an issue because they continue to publish in the basement. So this is in the emergency department. This unfortunate gentleman, if you notice, he's got a right leg, but he has no left leg. He stepped on a landmine. And this is another patient, similar kind of thing, and I apologize for the grossness, but just to give you a sense of the violence that a landmine will wreak. Landmines are not designed to kill the individual. It's designed to wound the individual so that four or six of his comrades have to remove him from the battlefield, and then a huge amount of medical resources are spent on it. So Hurricane Mitch, I was asked in 1988 in November to go to Honduras and work on medical relief for Hurricane Mitch. So this is what we saw in Tegucigalpa. And again, this is kind of leading up to Kosovo. There was water everywhere, and the water was the problem. So it devastated the country. Honduras in 1998 was affected by a complex humanitarian disaster. Livelihoods were disrupted. There was a great, you know, like 6,000 people were killed. Tens of thousands were injured. The infrastructure was destroyed. Most all the bridges were lost. So that was a classic complex humanitarian disaster. This is taken from, this site is isolated. We had to take canoes across. And this whole area of Honduras was cut off from anything but helicopters. So small boats would bring equipment and medicine and food across, and then we'd go over and provide care for the folks on the other side. It took them almost 6 months to string another bridge. And then we set up clinics in the bush on the edge of the forest. And this child had dysentery. And you know, the interesting thing, treating people in a disaster, in an unorganized situation, you have to use the facilities and the equipment that they have available. So in this case, we used a clinic building, but the clinic building was just kind of a sham. In a lot of these countries, they'll build clinics to say that they've got 10,000 clinics. They have a clinic in every region, but in reality, they're just shells that they really provided very little medical care. The medical care was provided by the private practitioners that made money off of it. So we set up our free clinic in this with no windows, mosquitoes, dengue fever, malaria everywhere, and kids everywhere. And we slept in the same clinic. So how did I prepare myself for this? Well, I've been involved in wilderness search and rescue, both doing it and training people. We provide what's called rock medicine in the Bay Area, where we provide medical relief at concerts, large concerts where people can't get out and get care. We do the initial triage. We treat them if we can, and otherwise we send them to the local hospital. And then this was in Kathmandu. These are Tibetan refugees escaping across the Himalayas, and we provided medical care. This was in 1988, and if you notice, they're mostly young men because the older people died on their way across. These people crossed the Himalayas, you know, 10 days, no food, in canvas, you know, Chinese sneakers. So very, very hardy bunch. And this is in West Africa, the country of Ghana, where we started a hospital and provided administration. This is an unfortunate child that died the next day of dysentery, and we had an IV line into his tibia, into his leg bone, as we could not start an IV anywhere else. So these are the 10 priorities in a disaster response. And it goes in descending order of importance. Now, most people go in and provide medical care because that's what they know, that's what they're used to. But it's more important to provide these other things than medical health care for simple reason. The second biggest killer of children in a disaster is, you know, if we close one of the back doors, I think the reflection. So the biggest killer of children in a disaster is what? Dysentery and diarrhea, and then dehydration and death. Okay? Whereas measles is the second biggest killer of children in disasters. So that's why immunization is important. Water and sanitation, without that, then this will be overwhelmed. Then food, shelter, then healthcare, communicable diseases on down. And again, you can't skip a step, just like in ACLS, just like in treating a heart attack victim, you've got to go stepwise, otherwise you miss something. So I'm just going to illustrate the different steps in my mission to Kosovo. So this is the country of Kosovo. Albania butts up against it, Macedonia, and then Serbia to the north. We were stationed in Prizren, and we provided our medical care right on the border. There's only a couple roads out, and before the NATO troops took Kosovo, we were treating people where like 400,000 people went across that very narrow gap there. So this was in April, the end of March, April of 99. I was asked to go in and bring a medical relief team into Albania to provide for the refugees. And just to give you a perspective, huge number of residents were driven from their homes. Almost a million people were forced out of the country. There's a question on the exact number of dead. Then there was the bombing, and we all know what occurred. Then after the bombing, the KFOR troops went in to Kosovo. Most of all the buildings, schools, houses, and facilities in the country were damaged in one way or the other. They were either completely destroyed or damaged. And again, this is terrorism. The reason for it was if your house is destroyed, then you'll move on. So it wasn't just to be mean. They purposely went and damaged enough things to encourage people to move on and not come back. So we arrived in Pristina. We had to get to northern Albania. Many of the roads were out, so we had to go by military helicopter about half the time. Of course, these big transport planes could only land at one airport in the country, in the capital city, so everything had to be brought by the smaller aircraft. Our initial thing was to do the assessment. To get the assessment, you had to determine numbers. We didn't have the time or the language skills to obtain the numbers, so we immediately, in the first couple days, hired drivers, logisticians, and public health people to get the information for us. And it's kind of interesting. We quickly determined number of persons per latrine. There were no latrines, so that's kind of a no-brainer. Retrospective mortality, well, it's a socialist kind of government. They say, well, everyone's immunized. Well, we don't have any of this. Well, that's not true. So we had to disregard that data, the number of water available. Well, it was a hose. So, how much water can go through a hose? So, it's not real science. So the next thing is shelter. And this is what people were living in. And this is just what we saw as we entered Kosovo itself. And it looks like World War II. It looks like a nuclear... there's not as much blast injury, but they went house to house to house and did their havoc. Now, guess who caused this baby? NATO bombs. And smart bomb. And the idea was to bomb the bridge, not destroy it completely, because they wanted to be able to rebuild it quickly, and they wanted to allow small vehicle traffic to continue to pass. So this is our high-tech armored Yugo. All the other groups, Doctors Without Borders, CARE, Save the Children, they had white Toyota Land Cruisers with, some with bulletproof glass and some not. We had a yellow Yugo. So medical care, disease surveillance in a disaster scene is not real fancy and it's not real complicated. Basically, you keep it simple. And if they have a rash, a fever, and one of the following, they have measles by definition. You treat it as if it's measles. You quarantine them, and you immediately vaccinate the whole group. Otherwise, it could spread like wildfire. So we did see measles, but we were able to quarantine, and we were able to get the vaccinations on soon enough that there was not a major outbreak. And again, this is measles, red eyes, stuffy nose, rash. Okay, so this is our vaccination project. The kids are very healthy. When they first came across, they were healthy, but the longer they were away from home, the longer they were in the camps, the sicker they became. So, water's next. It took us a week to get these tap stands. It went from a single hose to multiple stands that easy on kind of nozzles that don't spread disease. So this was a major coup, and it took a week. And Doctors Without Borders provided these inflated water bladders that they could fly in thousands of them. And again, it took like 4 days just to get this set up. And we didn't have the heavy equipment to cut the trenches, and we didn't have the wood to create the shelter, but they did have blankets and a little bit of plastic sheeting. So our first thing, you know, every night I would call for supplies. I'm northern Albania, right on the border. I can hear shelling, and I'm calling the capital city. I need wood, and I need plastic sheeting, and I need shovels. You know, and they say, we're working on it. You know, I need that more than I need medications. So one that gets involved in disaster relief needs to be able to do many different jobs and adjust quickly. Then moving down the list, shelter, then food. We always consider these nutritional deficiencies. The children were basically healthy to start with, so we didn't see any of this, but we did see a lot of this in Africa. And one needs to be prepared to diagnose it and then to treat it. And again, this is all in the handout. So, food distribution. This was in Moroni, right outside of the border with Kosovo. The interesting thing is, this is actually in the city of Kukës. They brought the food in. And if you haven't done it, it's intuitive, but if you've not done it, when you bring food in, the trucks are outside of the city, locked up until there's enough food for 120,000 people. Not a single truck is brought in, and then the trucks go throughout the city and open up at the very same time. They synchronize watches because people can be killed in the ensuing food fights. So the trucks had bread left at the end of the day. They were that careful about having enough. These are the communicable diseases that we worry about. We saw a fair amount of this, but then, you know, some of the more rare stuff we didn't see. But we're constantly on the lookout. And this is our shelter. So we moved quickly over shelter. We didn't have the resources. We provided plastic sheeting, and they all had a red tractor for some reason. It's like the government issued red tractors. And then this is Kosovo itself. You know, Yellow Yugo. And the only thing that protected us were our little placard. So vectors, there were no mosquitoes because it was mountains. Lice, scabies, fleas became more and more of a problem because they pass on typhus and other infectious diseases. So we arrive into, or we're ready to go into Kosovo, and we had no idea what kind of medical system, because they reported one thing to the rest of the world, but the reality was that most of the care was provided by a shadow system, and this was just kind of a government shell game that many of these didn't really exist. So we actually had to go on the ground and visit the different regions to determine what the medical care really was. So we've moved down the list. We've provided the other things we could provide. Now we provide medical care. So this is our tent clinic, in with the people. We got donated tents. We brought our own medication. We hired physicians from the capital city to come up. And one would say, well, why do you guys do it? Why don't let the local people take care of their own? Well, she was afraid to leave the capital city because she had never left the capital city. And she heard that there were bandits up there, and it's the mountains, and it's frightening. So we provided them a little bit of money, but we provided the guidance to bring the physicians from the capital city up into the disaster scene. And unfortunately, many times I had to provide all the care because our physicians were unwilling or had to take a tea break or a cigarette break. And then we got the call up. So I go back home, and then in June, KFOR, Kosovo Force, moves into Kosovo. The Serbs slowly move out, and we come in a few days after they move in. So, huge line of traffic. And this is what we see going back in. Very happy people. And reminders constantly of the continuing threat of mines. The Serbs, the Bosnians, the Soviets, everyone places mines, because it's much less expensive than having a soldier, and it never sleeps, and it doesn't degrade. So all these roads were riddled with mines right on the edge of the road. So they would escort us in. And then, once again, this is what we saw. And this is not caused from huge bombs. This is caused from shelling or grenades, where they just systematically went in and destroyed these buildings as a terrorist tactic. So we've done our assessment. We've determined that shelter is as best as it's going to get. Water is plentiful. So on and so forth. We've moved down to healthcare. So we're providing healthcare. We've been asked by the U.S. government to go in and do an assessment and then start providing medical care for the people returning to Kosovo. So this is inside a medical clinic and military stuff and a grenade in the corner. So we saw this. We recognized it as a grenade. We immediately taped off the front of the door and moved on. So we had to go to like six clinics that were either destroyed or mined before we could find one that was usable. And along the way, as we're touring the country, this is what we saw. So the Serbs claimed that this was damage caused by Allied bombs. You know, and clearly it was Allied bombs and it was bombing civilian targets. Well, we were instructed by our drivers that this was not caused by an Allied bomb. There's no blast damage. There's a lightweight roof. This is a firebomb from within. So a lot of disinformation. And this is what the clinics, we would mark with yellow tape that there's a mine inside. We go to the German soldiers who have control of this region and ask for them to go in and demine our clinics. And they said maybe next year. They had, you know, the first thing were the power plants and then municipal buildings and then schools. Clinics were down on the list. So we used a storefront instead of a clinic, which, again, only makes sense if you think about it. Why use a clinic building that could be mined, or poisoned or whatever, when you can just use another building? So a couple doors down, they donated their storefront. We put cardboard in the windows and we started seeing patients. This is an American doctor and an Albanian doctor. So needless to say, a lot of psychopathology present at the time and will be present in the future. But again, this is the biggest problem in a disaster, is uncontrolled chronic psychiatric illnesses. Schizophrenia. If a schizophrenic does not have their medicine, it gets real ugly. They don't sleep. They scream all night long. So if you're in a group, if you're in a disaster situation, and you have thousands of people grouped together, and there's one person running around screaming all night or crying, it's very, very upsetting. So we brought plenty of psychiatric medication, Haldol. Basically, we had Haldol and Valium. That was it. So it was like a little more Haldol, a little more Valium, you know, whatever it was needed. And we were asked also to staff a Serbian enclave of Serbs that were forced from their homes and beaten. And this is right next to where we provided our care. And we needed the German soldiers to protect the region from reprisals. So this was a woman brought to our clinic by the German military, instead of brought to the hospital, because they were worried she would be killed in the hospital. So they carry this 80-year-old woman in who had been beaten about the head and neck and was dehydrated, and her Serbian husband was killed and had, you know, was dead next to her for 7 days. It was a very ugly scene. So they bring her to us. She's in a coma. So I get a call on the radio, and I say, take her to the hospital immediately. She's beyond what we're capable of doing. They said, no. We take her to the hospital, they'll kill her. You must care for her at our field hospital. Well, we had nothing, so it was back and forth. Finally, they took a convoy in, took her to the hospital. Then later that day, I came in to see her. How would you encourage the local Albanian doctors to not allow her to die? What would you pay them? Would you be nice to them? What would be the best technique? Well, we had to think quickly, and we determined the best technique was to be nice to the people around her. She was on this bed. So I examined these other patients in the room. We brought them things. We brought them water. I consulted on the other people so that they would treat our patient well by being nice to them. We also talked to her doctor, complimented them. You know, it was something that I hadn't anticipated, but that's as important as anything else. Now, this was the patient right next to our patient. And any of the physicians in the room want to tell me what she has? So her right leg is extremely swollen and bruised all the way up to a defined point. And this acutely happened, and she'll get better, and she'll never have this again. And it happened in a millisecond. This is a snake bite. This is a rattlesnake bite to her lower leg. The swelling and bruising goes to a certain point, and then it stops. They didn't have antivenom, so they basically watched it progress. It stopped, and she slowly got better. But if you notice, no diapers and, you know, a sheet. So we brought her diapers. I examined her and gave the family advice. So this was a woman brought to our enclave, a Serbian woman beat about the trunk and arms, and she has a fractured wrist. The German soldiers put a splint on, and again, this is the importance of having some training in improvisational healthcare, whether you're a physician or not. A chair leg worked well. Unfortunately, it wasn't padded, and they forgot to take her ring off. So her finger, 3 days into this, was almost dead, was almost necrotic from the decreased blood flow. So in their rush to splinter, they didn't remove the ring. So I removed it using the infamous string technique where you wrap the string around and then slowly withdraw it. And of course, I was the immediate hero because there was no way to cut this ring off because it was so deeply embedded into her swollen finger. So these are some of the local Kosovar women reminding us that we were doing good work. I'm going to finish by showing my latest exploit. Was I was asked to go to Turkey last year to do an assessment and set up medical clinics for the refugees, the displaced people. And just to remind you, the epicenter was right near the town of İzmit in central Turkey. Istanbul was up here. And there's a huge fault line that runs through. We were set up right there, right at the epicenter. Now, just to remind you, you know, in keeping with the whole idea of disaster response, the likelihood is of an earthquake less than a nuclear catastrophe. İzmit, Turkey, killed a huge number of people. San Francisco earthquake, 06, 700 dead, and many of those were dead of fires. Why the difference in the numbers? Notice, the magnitude was less in Turkey than in San Francisco. Building construction and the length of the earthquake. The İzmit one lasted for 45 seconds, so it just pummeled the buildings. And the buildings in San Francisco were all three stories back then, whereas these were multi-story. Just to remind you that the first day, most of the people survive, but as you go out, there's less survival. So I'm on a search and rescue team that worked on the Loma Prieta. This is the Cypress structure in Oakland. Two-layer freeway collapsed. There were cars under here with people alive, but we couldn't get to them because the reinforced concrete was so thick. We had to cut in from the top. And it was so thick, they didn't have the tools to cut through this much reinforced concrete. Now we have the tools. Because of this, now we have teams. Now we have teams that can get into this. And I'm on an urban search and rescue team in Oakland. So the reason we exist is because of this kind of concrete. Okay, so this is what we were seeing as we're getting ready to go to Turkey. The day we hear the earthquake hits, we're called up to get ready. We're seeing this, you know, there was rubble across this young woman, and obviously, you know, everyone's dead, and, you know, and she's paralyzed, but she made it, and she's not paralyzed. And that's why we do the work we do, is to save people like this, even though it would appear that they would probably die. She did not die. So this is our team, the medical part of our team. There's 62 members, and we train every month. So we were ready to go. We didn't get the call up, so I went on my own. This is the Murr building in Oklahoma City. Again, same kind of devastation. So I got the call up to go with Relief International, which is a international humanitarian relief organization that provides medical care and other disaster relief all over the world. So we had pre-positioned equipment. We had disaster supplies. We had medications, splinting material, surgical material, you know, lights. We even had our own, you know, water purification stuff, camping stuff, pre-positioned in Los Angeles to go anywhere in the world. So it was sent to me overnight. Actually, I went down to Los Angeles, picked it up, flew on to Turkey with this in one of my residents, and we went to it. So, once again, in a disaster situation, just to get to where you're going to provide the medical care, this is what you see. So you've got to be prepared to go through the war zone to get to where you need to be. Notice, one side of the road, other side of the road. Same earthquake, different construction. And this is what we saw over and over and over, is one building, barely a crack of the plaster, and the other, once it starts to go, it's toast. 40,000 people dead. Now, just to remind you, the 10 priorities in an emergency are these things: initial assessment, measles on down, and then healthcare. So we looked at, we're doing our assessment the first day. We looked at the other healthcare facilities, and the other thing, in an earthquake in other countries, none of the buildings are usable after an earthquake until they've been assessed, because the base can be so compromised that a small aftershock could flatten it. So we go there prepared to, you know, stay in someone's house and use some facilities, but all the buildings in a city of 300,000 were unusable. Everyone was sleeping outside, unless it was a one-room, you know, small building, where in Turkey it's all multi-story. So everyone was camping out. The hospital had to be converted to a tent hospital. Now, this is a prime example of misplaced thinking. This was a French team that brought in their $12,000 defibrillator unit, you know, that can shock people back, and all this stuff. And what's wrong with this picture? No, they had generators. There are no patients. This is a disaster. Where are all the patients? Well, they set this up on the side of town where it was safe, and they had barricades and they had all this stuff. They had a helicopter landing port. But the patients weren't willing to leave their homes, weren't willing to leave their neighborhoods, even if they were very sick. So we set up within their neighborhoods. And we carried, you know, this is a backpack. These are, you know, medications and supplies. All of it we would carry in to start our clinics. And we immediately start our clinic, and, you know, our first patient comes in having a full-blown seizure and, you know, complicated. She's not waking up, and she's gagging. And, you know, so when you provide disaster relief, one needs to be prepared to deal with any inevitability. Luckily, we had Valium, and luckily she came out of it, and we actually had Dilantin also. But it can get, you know, a little bit hairy. And then the subsequent aftershocks, we were there already providing medical care. We were not there for search and rescue. We were asked to go for medical. Whereas when the secondary aftershocks happened and all the other search and rescue teams had gone home, we were asked to go in and assist in the search and rescue. And again, these are people, you know, the shelter, everywhere I've showed you, it's shelter, shelter, shelter. This blue plastic became very valuable. And just to remind you, in Turkey, these were the real heroes. These were the local people that pulled out the initial survivors and then pulled out the tens of thousands of people that died, and they'll have lasting psychological trauma. They're very strong now. They show no emotion. But all these disasters result in severe psychological trauma that will show up in the future. So that's all I have. We can turn the lights up. So I'll take any questions.
Dr. Stinson, we've heard that the Muslims in Kosovo were deprived of their arms by the United Nations or other organizations, and that if they had those arms, they would have been able to resist and avoided some of this disaster. You have an opinion about that?
Well, again, my involvement was medical, you know, non-political. But I have read the press, and I've talked to the local people. Basically, I think the death and destruction would have been greater if they had continued to have their arms, because the Serbs were so well supplied. They could drive from the capital of Serbia down to the capital of Kosovo in about 2 hours. You know, they could have thrown anything they needed into there to defeat the rebels. So I think they were just way outnumbered and outmanned. So I don't think if they had been able to continue the fight, I think more collateral, more innocents would have been killed, and the rebels with the guns would have retreated to the mountains that you saw in the background, and the cities would have been pummeled. Yes, sir.
Yeah, two questions. First, what do you do daily to keep yourself prepared for your personal health so you can survive these disaster scenes and not pick up the diseases yourself? And then number two, I understand that during World War II, the U.S. Army was very successful in keeping our troops free of typhus with DDT. What do you do about typhus today?
Well, and that's a very good question. What I do personally is I have a stock of the pre-medications one needs to take prior to deployment, like in the malarious areas. I have mefloquine in my, you know, little disaster bag. And as soon as I get the call up, I was prepared to go to Eritrea last week to do a similar kind of assessment, but the war ended and the, you know, the political imperative changed. So I have the medications ready to go. I've been treated with all the vaccinations known to man, including rabies and, you know, as far as typhus, in a disaster, everything changes. The idea of, you know, chemicals that are harmful, you know, blah, blah, blah. In a disaster, that's all out the window, and we use whatever chemicals we need to keep down any kind of epidemic. So as far as keeping down typhus, we would use whatever means necessary in the camps. But in the areas that I was, there was very little typhus because it was the wrong time of year, it was cold, and it was in the mountains. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question about the bombing. It was probably done by the American Air Force that they used, they referred to as depleted or spent uranium. I'm not quite sure what that is. And supposedly a lot of discussion about the after effects of that long range on toxicity and et cetera. What can you say about
that? Well, that's a very good question, and I have a particular interest in that. I think in Kosovo, there was virtually none of that used because there was so much backlash about its use in the Gulf War. You know, spent uranium is very, very heavy, and it can puncture armor. This is my lay understanding, that lead, it's heavier than lead, and lead will puncture so much, spent uranium will puncture armor, and once it gets into a tank, it'll somehow explode, and it's not the uranium that kills the people, but it's the actual explosion of it. So I think in Kosovo there was very little use. I understand the Persian Gulf is riddled with this spent uranium, and the, you know, the toxic effects will be there for centuries. But that's all I know.
Well, I understood that a lot was used in bombing Serbia proper.
Ah.
And now, what about the people who live in those cities and that stuff laying around there? What is the effect of that?
Again, my personal opinion is that's a criminal activity to do that. I think long-term, again, I'm not a specialist in this, so I can't really speak to the long-term effect.
A little comment on spent uranium. Your description is exactly right. It is extremely dense material. It is used as a solid round in an anti-tank gun because it penetrates armor. It is not explosive at all, any more than lead is explosive. And what depleted uranium is, you mine natural uranium out of the ground, run through the enrichment process to extract the uranium-235, which is 0.7% of natural uranium. The remaining is the primarily uranium-238, with a little bit of the 235 removed. It's mined from the ground and refined. It is not explosive. It is slightly radioactive. Uranium, like many other substances like potassium-40 and bananas, is all around us. But it's very dense. It makes an excellent armor-piercing round. Just thought I'd put that in for what it's worth.
A quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you see any evidence of natives using cluster bombs in Kosovo?
I did not but there were reports from the field that there were, you know, these, you know, a cluster bomb is a bomb that explodes before it lands and with all these little bomblets. And commonly, you know, they were used in Vietnam and there was a huge backlash and they were very colorful. And, you know, the horrific thing is the children would take them as toys, bring them back to the house, and then they would explode. Or they would pick them up and then explode in their hands. They're tiny little bombs and they can, you know, they're anti-personnel. If there were cluster bombs used, they would have, the Serbs would have had thousands of pictures of them, you know. And so I doubt that they were, and if it were, it was probably a very small scale. No. And no damage that could be attributed to it. Yes, sir?
I just want to add on the U-238, it's a very long-lived, very slightly active alpha emitter. You can sit on it forever. If you have a thin piece of paper, you're protected. It was also essentially a drag in the market, a very heavy material also used for ballast in 747s and other places where they need heavy metal. It was used, and I was really upset when people worried about the radioactive effect because it must be terribly trivial. Anyway, it was a heavy material. It was a good penetrating heavy. Anyway, add your comment. But it was, as far as I'm concerned, we worked with tons of natural U-238 with trivial radiation implications.
Mm-hmm. It seemed as though a lot of the work that you described was not really directly practicing medicine. I wonder if you think it would be advantageous to travel with, I don't know exactly what, hospital administrators or medical logisticians or
yeah,
like that.
Absolutely.
You could be freed from a lot of these tasks that I think, you know, any intelligent layman could do who had had some training as to the requirements for infrastructure to get to the point where it makes sense to practice medicine and not have to focus on that yourself.
Right, and that's a very brilliant, you know, a point. Unfortunately, it's like they gave me the call up. I was ready to go. They called a lot of other people. And I would have loved to have half a dozen people, a logistics person, a communication person, you know, someone that just did reports, someone that went out, four people to collect the data. But the group, you know, the finances are short, and you can only get so many people on a helicopter. You know, the UN would allow one person or two people to go up each day, you know, but absolutely. And that's what I'm trying to develop, a cadre, a team. Like, I was scheduled to go to Eritrea last week, and I had a team of people that were ready to go that had those other skills. But on the other hand, if you've got a limited number of people, having someone that can do multiple tasks and one that can barge into the Ministry of Health and say, I am Dr. Stinson, I am an American doctor asked to come here. And he's like, well, I got a niece that she has this. Can you help me out? And of course I will. And, you know, so there's some other secondary kind of, you know, physicians are respected all over the world, and especially American physicians. Yes, sir.
There's been an ongoing controversy about, you know, you mentioned all those multiple immunizations that you took in the military, these anthrax immunizations, about the safety and efficacy of those immunizations. Could you just touch on that a little bit, please?
Well, again, you know, I'm not an expert in that. I've read in the lay press about it. Anthrax immunization isn't very good at best. And anthrax, you know, as people know, I don't know if it was presented, anthrax historically was a contact. You would get it, and it wasn't that much of a problem. But it's only when it's inhaled, when it's when the spore is distributed in a droplet, and it's inhaled, it causes devastating consequences. So that's what one would do in the military. Anthrax, normally, once it settles to the ground, it's not a problem. So, you know, I don't know about the long-term consequences and the political consequences. A lot of the Gulf War syndrome was thought to be blamed on vaccinations. But lately, I think an interesting insight was the bombing of the chemical and biological plants upwind of the troops resulted in a huge exposure, not concentrated but low-level exposure to neurotoxins and all sorts of stuff. And that was never reported initially because they didn't want the troops to be frightened, to be freaked out. You know, so that was all kind of hush-hush. And then later on, you know, so I can't really speak on anthrax. But I wouldn't want to be vaccinated with it. Would not. So, any other questions? Well, thank you for having me.